you're flying so low on these fires, even on a big plane like the Super Scoop, which is almost the size of a C-130, it's a huge aircraft, but you're coming in low enough, you can see people's face, you can see the look on their face, and you can look out the window, and every now and then you'll catch a glimpse of somebody waving at you, or they got a fist in the air, and they're cheering you on, and they're happy to have you there defending their community and their home.
Hi, I'm Paul. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Tim Sheehy, CEO at Bridger Aerospace, which is one of the most advanced aerial firefighting companies in the United States. Now, Tim has a unique story. He's a graduate of the Naval Academy and a retired Navy SEAL, who now applies many of the skills he acquired overseas to fighting fires on the homeland.
I was part of a hostage rescue operation where we were using a whole host of aerial surveillance assets with different types of modalities and different sensors to try to find where this hostage was. And when we located the hostage, it was a multifaceted effort, and a lot of it depended on all the different types of data me and my team and our team had collected to find that location. I really realized, man, this aerial surveillance capability is incredible. It would be great someday if I ever get out of the military to find a way to apply this to other public safety tasks like wildfire, like border patrol, like search and rescue, et cetera, et cetera.
Wildfires have rapidly become one of the major economic and environmental issues of our time. I say this as somebody who lives on the West Coast as well. So I reached out to Tim to gain a better understanding as to what it takes to fight fires from the air, what his company does differently, and as far as it relates to what we do at Icon Aircraft, how do they use seaplanes, and how are seaplanes one of their greatest assets in the fight?
And I think that's another thing that is unique in us with Icon, a shared characteristic there is, it's not a float plane. It's not a plane that's designed for something else that floats attached. You know, these are purpose-built seaplanes. And to be a good seaplane, in my opinion, you really need to be purpose-built.
Now, this episode provides an overview of the challenges and current capabilities of aerial firefighting and what needs to be done to get ahead of the issues at hand. Now, in addition to being CEO of Bridger, Tim's also a pilot, and he flies on many other missions. He shares a few of his most memorable flying experiences and adventures on this episode and some of the really, truly unforgettable lessons he's taken away from them.
You know, how quickly things can go bad is the moral of that story, because it happened in a matter of seconds, and it went from being a beautiful day where, you know, hey, this was a low risk training flight, right? There wasn't supposed to be anything wrong. We were in a little seaplane in the middle of Florida on a beautiful day, going to go for a flight, and always be prepared to respond and be prepared for an emergency, because you don't know when it's going to hit, and rarely will it hit when you think it's going to.
So this is a story about sticking to your mission, a respect for the hazards that mission may bring, and embracing the adventures that come your way.
For me, it's always been, you know, a life of purpose and having a mission. You know, it's always been very, very important to me to make sure that what I do every day is relevant, it's impactful, and it's helping somebody.
This is Adventure Flying. Yeah, I mean, you could introduce yourself in a million different ways. And I mean, obviously, you have a very rich background from military to, you know, it sounds like you started aviation at an early age. I guess for me, the best place I'd want to start is, how did you go from Operation Enduring Freedom, your SEAL operations, to firefighting? What was the connective tissue there? And where are you today versus where you started?
Certainly. So I started flying as a young child. I grew up on a lake in Minnesota, and my neighbor was a Navy pilot. So he took me up flying for the first time when I was about 8. And he landed his Piper Cub on the lake out there on the ice, also sometimes as a seaplane. So I started off, you know, in that realm. And really the aviation bug got me early. And I ended up going to the Naval Academy with hopes of being a Navy pilot. During my time at the Academy, of course, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan scaled up, and it was clear that flying for me was a selfish desire. The nation really needed folks on the ground over there fighting the ground war. So I ended up going into the special operations community as a SEAL officer and did several deployments, but I still had my pilot roots. I still had my passion for aviation. I loved aerospace and airplanes and everything related to that. So through my deployments as a SEAL, the Special Operations Task Force was really the pioneers in integrating aerial surveillance and air support seamlessly with ground operations. And prior to the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, air-to-ground coordination had always been a fairly clunky activity. It was rarely like you see in the movies where everything's called in perfectly the second you need it exactly where you want it. It was a lot of friendly fire, a lot of messiness. And one thing the Special Operations Task Force pioneered was really understanding how to integrate, especially surveillance assets into real-time operations. And in previous wars, you know, aerial surveillance, aerial photography, aerial reconnaissance was something where a picture would be taken and it could be evaluated, you know, hours or days later. It wasn't part of the real-time operation. And downlinking video, downlinking images from a drone or from a manned aircraft overhead to the hands of an operator on a target was really a revolutionary development and kind of a watershed moment in how forces on the ground could tactically employ assets in the air. So with my pilot background and now being a SEAL team leader on the ground overseas, I was one of the early guys to really start getting my head around some of the technology that we could employ to further this capability. And in one instance, I was part of a hostage rescue operation where we were using a whole host of aerial surveillance assets with different types of modalities and different sensors to try to find where this hostage was. And when we located the hostage, it was a multifaceted effort, and a lot of it depended on all the different types of data me and my team and our team had collected to find that location. And while that was going on, I really realized, man, this aerial surveillance capability is incredible. It would be great someday if I ever get out of the military to find a way to apply this to other public safety tasks like wildfire, like border patrol, like search and rescue, et cetera, et cetera. I ended up getting wounded and was medically finished up in the service and said, hey, no time like the present. My wife, she was a Marine, so she'd been serving active duty as well. And we decided to just jump in with both feet and start our company to try to solve this challenge of aerial surveillance. And that's where Bridger Aerospace was born, which is our company. And Bridger Aerospace obviously morphed into a pure firefighting company. We developed sensors and capabilities to map wildfires in real time. So really have helped pioneer that. And along the way have become seaplane operators with our SEAL 415 class of aircraft and other aircraft associated with that, that have made us a seaplane operation. And of course, that's a whole world of flying that's unique. And aerial firefighting is a unique realm of flying, as is seaplane. As is backcountry and mountain aviation. So there's so many unique disciplines that connect here at Bridger, and it's a really fun place to fly and be a part of. And there's never a day without an adventure when you're fighting fires from the air.
And so you became a master or one of the global leaders in ground air reconnaissance, surveillance. There's obviously a lot of crossover with that, with aerial firefighting, but was there a moment where you thought about maybe some other realm where that could be used? I mean, there's plenty of urban environments where that skill, I'm sure, would lend itself. Aerial firefighting, you gravitated to that because of the seaplane as well, or were there other thoughts to use your skills somewhere else?
Now, the seaplane really came along later, and I can explain how we ended up in seaplanes too. But when we started Bridger, the focus was really a fairly nebulous concept that aerial surveillance was a hugely beneficial capability for us in OIF and OEF. And there were so many other realms of public safety activities in the US, from border patrol, law enforcement, to again, search and rescue, wildland firefighting, that could benefit from enhanced aerial surveillance. So we started the company in November of 2014, just two of us. It was a pure bootstrap. We bought an old plane from NOAA, an old Shrike Commander. And we developed some very rudimentary sensors and basically started testing our platform. And how we got into fire was, as we were testing, we were flying for local ranchers to look for lost cattle, you know, who had walked off the ranch up in the national forest land, and using our infrared sensors to try to find and locate those lost cattle. And during that process, the local Forest Service office had heard about and seen what we were doing. And they came out and said, hey, you know, we see you're flying a Twin Commander around with an infrared camera. You know, that could be super helpful for us in wildfire management. Have you guys thought of flying for the Forest Service? And we said, yeah, I mean, we thought about it, but it wasn't really front of mind for us. So they said, well, come on, we got a contract coming up. Why don't you try to bid on it and see if you can fulfill that role? So we ended up bidding on the contract. We won a spot on it. And so began our journey into aerial firefighting in the summer of 2015 with one old Shrike Commander and some infrared cameras. And as that journey developed, we purchased more aircraft and grew the fleet and grew the staff and then grew the technology. as well, developed some very advanced sensor technology, which we actually ended up spinning out into a separate company, Ascent Vision Technologies, and that actually has become a fairly large defense contractor for providing air defense and sensor systems to the DoD. But that's another story. So we got into the forest firefighting aspect from a surveillance mission role, which is called ATGS, Air Tactical Group Supervisor. And the role of those aircraft is to fly over the fire incident, manage the fire from the air, and deconflict all the other assets that are going to respond to that fire. Because when you look at a wildfire incident, you can have 10, 20, 30, 40 aircraft operating in and around that fire, helicopters, drones, air tankers, smoke jumpers. There's a lot of air assets and ground assets working in a very tight area around a wildfire. So the Air Tactical Group Supervisor, the Air Attack as they're called, is the one overhead coordinating all that and deconflicting all that. And that was the start of our firefighting journey, what was as the Air Attack mission. As we saw the wildfire aviation community and saw it operating and started to understand it more, we saw these amphibious aircraft, the Super Scoopers, operate. They came down out of Canada and were operating. We saw how effective they were and kind of asked ourselves, you know, I wonder why there aren't more of these operating down here. And as we dug into the issue, realized, you know, the factory had been closed for about a decade. So we worked hard to get the factory reopened and were able to do that and be the launch customer for the new version of the aircraft. And as a result, became seaplane operators. And since then, we've invested heavily in that program and have gotten into the world of seaplane operations, which is an amazing place to be. It's a small world. It's a smaller world unto itself from aviation. And it's a really fun place to be a part of.
I hesitate to use the word adventurous with firefighting because it has to be so demanding. And I mean, it's ongoing and what have you. But where does the adventure come in with what you're doing in your day to day?
Well, I mean, there's so much adventure just baked into all this. And I come from a background where there's been a lot of adventure for me, you know, from South America to Iraq to Afghanistan to, you know, I drove mini submarines in the Navy and parachuted out airplanes. So I've been, you know, I've had a fairly adventurous life prior to starting this company. And now I'm on a new adventure, which is aerial firefighting. And as you said, every day is an adventure. And again, I think one of the great things that's unique about aerial firefighting, and specifically our type of aerial firefighting, is you've got mountain flying, which is kind of considered a unique, demanding area of aviation. You've got seaplane operations, which is unique. You got to be a boat driver and a pilot, and then aerial firefighting, which is a whole other aspect. So you know, we kind of combine all those, and so many adventures come from that. And I think for us, you look at how demanding aerial firefighting is. It's probably the most demanding aviation operation in the world. You know, obviously military operations are demanding. However, they don't happen all that frequently. And there's not a lot of dogfights going on, not a lot of, you know, active bombing missions. So as demanding as it is, it doesn't happen all the time. Whereas our pilots every day, you know, every day for 6-7 months a year, they're out there, you know, flying sometimes 85 to 100 drops a day or more on a fire. So low altitude through mountains, through the thermals and the turbulence that's created by a massive wildfire incident. Deconflicting with all of the aircraft, the smoke and the ash. It's a high risk environment. It's an adrenaline inducing environment. And I can't imagine a more critical mission for aviation than what we're doing, especially when you look at the complexity of the size of so many of these incidents. So for all of our pilots, myself included, I fly as much as I can as a relief pilot in the Scoopers. Every day is an adventure out there and keeps us on our toes. And it's an amazing mission to be a part of.
And so the Super Scooper is the primary aircraft you're using, you know, on a day-to-day. Is that the aircraft your pilots are utilizing the most?
So we have, we cover various functionalities within, you know, the aerial firefighting community. Our core areas are really air attack. And for that mission, we fly the Twin Commander and the Kodiak, the Dire Kodiak. So we have... a fleet of those. We have a fleet total of about 20 aircraft, about 60 pilots. So we operate fixed wing wheeled aircraft, and then fixed wing, obviously seaplanes. We don't operate any rotor wing. So the Super Scooper is our flagship right now. We own and operate four of those on federal contracts, and then we have some others that are coming online in production to go on a contract as well in the next few years. And those are obviously a big investment. They're one of the very few purpose built seaplanes in the world. And I think that's another thing that, is unique in us with Icon, a shared characteristic there is it's not a float plane. It's not a plane that was designed for something else with floats attached. You know, these are purpose-built seaplanes. And to be a good seaplane, in my opinion, you really need to be purpose-built for that. The aircraft needs to be designed for that. And just adding floats to a plane, it can be great, it can be fun, but it's never going to be a true seaplane.
So every Icon A5 owner must go through Icon's training program to show they are proficient in low altitude flying and water operations. While the Icon A5 is a two-seat light sport aircraft and is vastly different than the Super Scooper in respect to its size and mission, the aircraft that Tim's referring to, but both are flying low over the water in remote terrain and were specifically built for operating on the water. So given this connection, what training and experience is a Super Scooper pilot or a seaplane aerial firefighting pilot expected to have? And what is usually their primary background?
It's a mixture. And, you know, like any company, you know, we're fairly young. We're only 6 years old now. So we're growing. And our pilot pipeline is a mixture. You've got a lot of former military guys who are coming out of demanding aviation missions in the military. You got a lot of bush guys from Alaska who have float time, who have backcountry time, mountain time, which is all very helpful in firefighting. So we have a mix. And essentially, you know, how it's kind of come down is our Canadian, the aircraft is Canadian. The Super Scoopers are Canadian. They were born in Canada. And I should add, they're the only aircraft ever specifically designed to fight fire. Every other firefighting platform is a converted aircraft from another type, you know, airline or military, crop duster, whatever. The Super Scooper is the only aircraft ever designed from day one to go fight fires. And as a result, they're very commonly used in Canada because that's where they're built. So we, our SMEs, our captains for the aircraft come out of Canada, guys with, you know, decades of experience flying these. And then our first officers are American guys who have a lot of experience in the air attack realm, to flying smoke jumpers, other aspects of fire aviation in the U.S. Because each country does firefighting a little bit differently as far as how the tactics are used in the communications. So it's a little bit different wherever you go, whether it's Europe, Spain, Italy, Greece, Canada. And then a lot of our air attack pilots who fly the commanders and the Kodiaks are coming from the military. They're coming from Alaska. And then those guys will get their experience flying fire. And then they will end up moving into the Super Scooper slots as those slots open up. So a mixture of background, but I think, you know, how it relates to your pilot community is, you know, everyone starts flying somewhere. And, you know, I started flying as a kid with my neighbor. Some people start flying as a hobby and they enjoy it and realize, hey, I want to do this for a job. So I think, you know, if someone's out there flying an Icon and deciding, hey, I'd love to quit my day job and fly for a living, you know, I think a lot of people view seaplane pilots as it's a recreational community, which is probably true in most regards, but there is an industry of professional seaplane pilots, and those most notably are in the firefighting realm. So there is a professional path to pursue, you know, out of the recreational world of seaplane aviation.
What conditions or circumstances would you guys not fly in? I feel like you're always flying in horrible conditions, right? Is there any type of, you know what I mean, to be kind of ignorant?
Yes.
Here, yeah, no, but what would those be? And
no, I mean, once again, I mean, aero firefighting, it's all, you know, we're all creatures of our environment. So aero firefighting, as you said, is inherently a hazardous mission. You're flying in low visibility with smoke. You're flying at very low altitude. Obviously, we're scooping the water, and you know, we're scooping 1500 gallons of water, which means we're touching the water and taking off again at 90 knots. And then we're going over to the fire and we're dropping it, you know, treetop level, 100 feet or so, which, you know, 100 feet in pine trees, you know, basically means you're flying, you know, almost at treetop level coming in to drop those loads on the fire. And you're not doing that once. You're doing that 80, 100, 120 times a day. And that's the beauty of the Super Scooper. That's the impact of it, is it can drop more, it can put more water on a fire in one day than any other asset in the world. There are these huge tankers that can drop 10, 20,000 gallons. That's great. They have their role. They're dropping retardant, but they'll give you 2, 3, 4, 5 drops a day, you know, at most. Whereas our aircraft, you know, they're coming in and, as I said, doing 40, 50, 60, 80, 100, 130 drops a day. And they're getting more fluid on the fire. You know, a tanker will get you 20, 30,000 gallons a day, maybe 10,000 gallons a day. We're getting you, you know, 150,000 gallons a day onto that incident. So the impact's greater. So, but there are conditions which, of course, will shut down aircraft on a fire. And of course, that'll come down to, you know, you're flying in the mountains, and mountain wave conditions, extreme turbulence can result. And additionally, the weather in the mountains is bad enough as it is. Sometimes these fires will create their own weather system. They'll be so big and so hot, they create a whole microclimate within the fire area that makes it very, very hazardous to fly. So, you know, we'll look at those conditions from turbulence to downdrafts to mountain wave to visibility and say, hey, this is a no-go today. Like, we're not flying. And the helicopters will normally fly in lesser visibility conditions because obviously, you know, they can hover, they can land, they're not flying at 150 knots. So they can go in a little bit lower vis, whereas fixed wing needs a little bit more vis. But, you know, as far as winds and turbulence and thermals, you know, that frankly impacts helicopters more than us. So it's kind of a give and take. But I mean, it's a low altitude game. You're always a low altitude. So, you know, altitude is not really a consideration. It's really the environmental conditions around the fire incident.
I'm interested in talking a little bit about you and your background, you know, to circle back a little bit more on the adventure front. Do you have a easy definition for adventure? Do you feed off adventure? Is it just, it's always kind of gravitated towards you, or have you sought it? What's your definition and what's your relationship with it?
Well, my wife and my mom would probably have a very different take on this than I do, but, you know, the way I see it, I've never sought it out. I don't go try to find, you know, adventure. I think, for me, it's always been, you know, a life of purpose and having a mission. You know, it's always been very, very important to me to make sure that what I do every day is relevant, it's impactful, and it's helping somebody. And that's what led me to the military. And that's what led me out of aviation at the Naval Academy. I'll never forget the day they pulled us in. It was my plebe year, and Iraq was going on, Afghanistan was going on. And they basically said, hey, I know everyone here wants to be a fighter pilot and be Maverick, but ultimately we need more Marines. We need folks on the ground. You know, the wars are dragging on. They're longer and tougher than we thought they were going to be. We need people. We're losing a lot of folks, and we need more folks. And to me, I said, wow, that's flying. I love to fly, and I want to fly, but that's a selfish desire. My country needs me on the ground. And if I'm going to go on the ground, I'll go with the best folks I possibly can. And that's how I ended up joining the SEALs. So, and then in the SEAL teams, obviously, you know, you're on the front lines all the time. And I was privileged to have some great leadership positions there and be able to do a lot of exciting things. And then when, you know, my career there was ended because of my wounds, I said, all right, what's next for me? And once again, came back to, you know, I got to have a life of purpose. There are certainly easier routes to take, but we chose to start the company and again, gravitated towards aero firefighting because once again, it's a massive issue, not just for Americans, but for the world now, with wildland urban interface growing and climate change. You know, the reality is our fire seasons are far more severe. They're longer, they're tougher. And it's challenging to build aviation infrastructure. You can't buy and build planes very quickly. It takes years. So our ability to scale our firefighting apparatus takes time. So there was a need, you know, from a patriotic standpoint, you know, our country needed us to supply this capability. I had a unique outlook, I think, on things coming from my background in the military with surveillance to apply a new type of capability to wildland fires to save lives and do it better. And that's how we got here. And you know, our trip into the Super Scoopers had a very similar mindset. We were looking at the shortage of air tankers, which, you know, if anyone wants to take time to read about it, they can read all about how short the United States is on firefighting aircraft and our air tankers. We're way below where we need to be. And as I looked at that shortage and said, man, these super scooping aircraft are an incredible asset. We need to find a way to get more of these. And once again, you know, the desire to do that came from a desire to serve and to save lives. And that's how we got into the seaplane world. So now it's a special mission. It's very hazardous. You know, just a quick Google search will show you how many unfortunate and tragic aerial firefighting crashes there are every year. Just a few weeks ago, with the BE-200 went down in Turkey, killing 8. You know, we lost a C-130 in Australia last year. Again, due to the winds and mountain wave over the fire, literally just the downdrafts just pushed them down on the ground. And that's like the fourth C-130 to have happen in a similar circumstance. So it's a hazardous job, but, you know, someone's got to do it. And what we're trying to do is be the absolute best operators out there. Not trying to be the biggest, trying to be the best. We're trying to invest in the best airframes, provide the best trained pilots, and the best technology to save as many lives as possible, as safely as possible.
Do you have a specific flight either you were a part of or your group was a part of, probably with an aerial firefighting, that you feel like offers a lesson to maybe the audience, maybe something you learned, or maybe even something that highlights the hazards and why it's important that we continue to invest in aerial firefighting, either a recent flight or even it was at the beginning, anything like that you feel like could be edifying to our audience?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've got a handful of flights. I'll talk through each one relatively quickly. And the first is a tragic accident I was a part of where I was flying a seaplane, a Twin B down in Florida. And it was a training flight, beautiful day. And, you know, like many initial training flights, we were operating out of a small airport on a good weather day to do a fairly, you know, prosaic series of maneuvers to get our multi-engine C rating. So it was me and several of Bridger pilots there getting our multi-engine C rating so that we could become Super Scooper pilots. We already had a single engine C rating, so we were getting our multi-engine C ratings. And, tragically, on takeoff, one of our engines failed completely, just quit completely. And as a result, we were at low altitude in this particular aircraft. The Twin B was a very underpowered plane. It's not a very aerodynamic plane. It's kind of a pig. And almost immediately, you know, the aircraft went into a VMC roll, and we ended up crashing into a house there right off the airport. And tragically, my instructor was killed, you know, on impact during the flight, and we crashed into a house. And some of the occupants were hurt. I was able to provide some medical care on site and help stabilize to the best of my ability. Again, I had medical training from my time in the military. And you know, how quickly things can go bad is the moral of that story, because it happened in a matter of seconds, and it went from being a beautiful day where, you know, hey, this was a low risk training flight, right? There wasn't supposed to be anything wrong. We were in a little seaplane in the middle of Florida on a beautiful day, going to go for a flight and, you know, bounce around to a few different lakes and learn how to be a multi-engine seaplane pilot. And I've flown hundreds of firefighting missions, you know, critical missions, low altitude, dropping water, thousands of gallons, you know, and a far higher risk environment, low visibility. You know, I had a fire just last week I can talk about where, you know, we were barely able to get back to the airport VFR, navigating through the smoke and landing. But you know, that's what the mission required. But here, you know, we had a low risk training day and beautiful weather, and tragedy struck. And I think for the Icon A5 community, where I think, you know, 99% of those flights are recreational, they're fun, they're out there enjoying themselves, things can change quickly. And always be prepared to respond and be prepared for an emergency, because you don't know when it's going to hit. And rarely will it hit when you think it's going to. So be prepared for it.
So obviously that's a story that illustrates a tragic lesson that pilots of any skill level should appreciate. And as mentioned, being an aerial firefighter is likely one of the most demanding positions in all of aviation. So I wanted to call attention to this next story from Tim, as I think it helps demonstrate just how much the hard work and getting back in the saddle can make all those demands really pay off and feel rewarding.
Every fire is unique and every fire flight is unique, but then at the same time, they're all kind of the same, wherein, you know, the mission is always getting the water on the fire in a way that's most advantageous to what's going on the ground, because any aerial firefighting asset or mission is the whole purpose of it is to help those on the ground, whether it's the firefighting crews on the ground who are building a defensive line against a town, or whether it's civilians trying to evacuate an area in time and you're trying to buy them time by slowing the fire down, or you're trying to slow the fire before it hits a structure or you know, what have you, infrastructure. So, you know, they start falling into kind of categories of fires, but I think the best story is very simply, you know, our first fire in the Super Scooper. And we had building the Super Scooper program was years in the making. We had to raise a lot of money to do it. It was a huge risk to our company. We were starting a factory fresh from a company who never built the Super Scooper before, because Bombardier had sold the program. And you know, the hoops we had to jump through with the FAA and the Forest Service and Transport Canada, it was, you know, it had been years of just, you know, Byzantine regulatory challenges to get us finally get these aircraft in our hands and get them approved for operation. So the first flight we were sent on was just, it was really special when finally I just happened to be there and was fortunate enough to be on that first dispatch. We were operating out of Minden, Nevada, and sent out to a fire near Elko, Nevada. And, you know, it was our first fire, and we were the first and only aircraft on scene, you know, supporting that fire incident. And it was really special to be there. We were scooping out of South Fork Reservoir there. And there were boaters on the lake because they hadn't yet closed the lake. It was a new start. So we were scooping out of the lake, and it's not uncommon to have boats there and early on the fire. And we had jet skis going next to us and a wakeboarder going by us as well. And everyone's just in awe of this huge, huge firefighting airplane scooping out of the lake. And it was kind of an amazing culmination of years of effort to build the Super Scuba program. And it was a great day on the fire. We had a tremendous impact, basically put it out over a course of 2 days. Other aircraft eventually ended up showing up and working with us on that fire. But it was a perfect first mission for us, and I'll never forget that day and how special it was and seeing the impact we were having. You know, you're flying so low on these fires, even in a big plane like the Super Scoop, which is almost the size of a C-130, it's a huge aircraft, but you're coming in low enough, you can see people's face, you can see the look on their face, and you can see, you can look out the window, and every now and then you'll catch a glimpse of somebody, and you know they're waving at you, or they got a fist in the air, and they're cheering you on, and they're happy to have you there defending their community and their home. And it's a tremendous feeling of fulfillment to see that and feel that and have that. And for our first fire to have it near a reservoir like that, near a town, we were able to have a very big impact. And it was noted by the agencies and by the civilians who live there that you know, we saved the day, and we were proud to be there to do that.
The A5, it's a unique aircraft for a number of reasons, but one of them is the retractable gear. I mean, you guys are doing so many runs to the water, you know, eventually you're returning to the land. Can you just walk me through briefly what that checklist is like? How do you prevent yourself from becoming complacent on what is essentially 80 landings in a 4-hour period of time? Obviously you have a checklist, but just kind of walk me through that, that safety portion of your flight, if you can.
Absolutely. So, you know, the Super Scoop is a 2-crew airplane. It's a Part 23 aircraft. It's a big aircraft, 45,000 pound gross weight. So it's a big airplane, and you've got a captain and a first officer in there. So, you know, I came from a single pilot background. So moving into the CRM, crew resource management world was a learning experience for me. I'd always, again, I had flown with other pilots, but as you know, and many folks will know, flying with other pilots, vice being a crew, is a very different thing. And when you're flying as a crew, captain, first officer, pilot, co-pilot, pilot on flying, pilot monitoring, whatever you want to call it, you're working, you are essentially acting as one person. And so in the Super Scooper, it's constantly, you know, the pilot and the first officer are back and forth, like in the front of an airliner. You're switching each other's switches. You're doing checklists together. Every checklist is completed together in some form or fashion. Either one pilot is calling for an item and the other pilot's doing it, or one pilot's calling it out and doing it, but confirming, the other pilot's confirming that it's getting done. So when it comes to gear specifically, absolutely right. I mean, gear down for a water landing is normally going to be a catastrophic accident for almost any plane, whether it's a float plane or a seaplane. So for us, you know, the system is, you know, obviously you've got your gear up or down switch, and then you've got a mode that you flip for the aircraft. So there's land mode and sea mode. So gear up, and once gear is up and you're on your way to the fire and you know you're going to be fighting the fire, you put the switch to sea mode. And then, you confirm that like anything you do in a two-crew checklist, it's confirmed. So you switch to sea mode and the other pilot will confirm that. I'm switching to sea, confirmed. Yes, that's confirmed. You are switched to sea. And then you are configured for firefighting. And for the rest of the mission, until you go back to the airport to refuel, you'll be in C mode. And you won't have to address that again because you are going to be in C mode. And your gear never comes down during that. Then when you're end of fuel cycle, your bingo fuel, you're heading back to the airport to land, you'll go through your post-bomb checklist. And part of that checklist is landing your switch to land. And then you will switch it to land, confirm it's in land. And then, of course, when you select gear down, you'll have the indicator lights and that will be another confirmation. So you're confirming multiple times that your gear is up or down prior to touching land or sea.
What do you think the next 10 years of fire, like where do you hope aerial firefighting is in 10 years? You know, do you need more pilots? You mentioned, you know, a lack of aircraft. Where do you hope you guys are in 10 years, the aerial fighting community as a whole? And where do you think the rest of the community, either aviation or just this country, really needs to help initiate the movement?
Mindset. We have to shift the mindset. We have to have a global year-round mindset to firefighting. You know, we're never going to knock down national borders, fair enough, but we need to, let's talk about the U.S. only, although I think what I'll say about the U.S. really does permeate to the rest of the world. But the U.S., you know, our federal government and our firefighting infrastructure was designed in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. You know, that's just when the post-World War II era, when we started fighting fires from the air, that structure remains in place, really. And, you know, the complexity of that structure, you've got so many different agencies that own and have a responsibility for public land, from the Forest Service to the Bureau of Land Management, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to the National Park Service, to the, you know, State Department of Forestries for all the states that have state forests, which is almost all of them, to Fish and Wildlife Service, to, you know, the list goes on and on and on. And all those agencies essentially have their own kind of contract vehicles and funding lines that support firefighting. So it's not a centralized, it's not like the military. We have a centralized approach to it. It's very siloed. And as a result, the money is siloed, and so are many of the policies. And that infrastructure was built around the wildfires being a seasonal and regional issue where, okay, it'll burn 2 to 3 months a year, you know, July, August, September. And, you know, when Arizona burns earlier in the year, then it'll drift up to, you know, Wyoming and Montana and Idaho. Then it'll shift out to Washington and down to California. And it'll always be a region that's on fire, and that fire alone, that region will only be on fire for, you know, 30 to 60 to 90 days at most. And every now and then we'd have a big year, but for the most part, those were an aberration. And what's happening for a lot of reasons, you know, you look at the Mountain West is growing exponentially from a population perspective. A lot more people are out here now camping, setting off fireworks, doing whatever it is they're doing. So a lot more people are out here starting fires. Additionally, however, most fires are still started by lightning. You do have the reality of whether you want to call it climate change or drought or whatever someone's personal preference they want to call it. Snowpack is getting less. The mountains are getting drier. And the forests are drying out sooner and worse than normal. So you're getting a longer fire season every year. And it's now starting to cover the whole West every year. It's not like one state will burn, then the next state will burn sequentially. They're all burning together at the same time. So you have a longer season and a wider season as far as the breadth of the issue. And our infrastructure isn't built for that. We don't have the number of aircraft and the number of people. And this includes ground crews. So it's not just an aviation issue. It's also ground crews. So nationally, we're just not in a position to deal with this at the level of which it's become. Because again, our infrastructure is built for a seasonal regional issue. Now it's a year-long, you know, nationwide issue. It's a national annual issue. So I don't think pilots are that much the concern, to be honest. I think the guys and girls who are drawn to aerial firefighting are a unique breed. It's not denigrating anybody else, but it's normally not the same people that want to fly airlines or corporate, you know, jet operations. It's just not, you know, we get the guys who are bush pilots or, you know, oil rig guys who are flying helicopters and oil rigs or, you know, military guys who are flying A-10s and low and slow stuff. It's a different breed of folk that want to be low, slow, dirty, you know, it's in that class of pilot, we don't really have a hard time finding those. And I think, you know, the pilot shortage that the airlines and have faced and are facing is because they're just dealing with a different demographic than we are.
Is it the drone pilot or the tech or the engineers then? You know, is it the people to give you the data and to bring them more into the fold in that industry?
I think that's part of it. And I think, again, shifting our mindset is the first thing we need to do and recognize this isn't a cottage problem. So I think, you know, that's the first step is shift our mindset to this. This is a national annual issue, not a seasonal regional one. And that starts in a couple of ways. Number one, more aircraft pre-positioned in regions ready to respond quickly. Initial attack, getting out there fast. There has been a culture within the wildland management agencies, which is valid, which is let the fires burn. Fires are natural. They're supposed to burn. And that's true. But sometimes then it's a lot harder to put out a fire when it's at 10,000 acres than when it's at 10 acres. So oftentimes we're letting those fires burn and then realizing once they've gotten too big, okay, now we got to put it out. And it's very, very, very hard to put it out when it's that big. So accepting an initial attack strategy where we get out there fast, get out there hard, and we hit it as soon as it starts as hard as we can. Overwhelm it with resources to put it out and then move on to the next one. And do those natural burns later or earlier in the year when the fuel is less volatile, and do a controlled burn when we can control that fire better, maybe when there's some snow on the ground. And then technology, like you said, data and technology are, you know, there's no magical solution we're going to have to solve wildfires. There's no app we're going to develop that's going to fix it. You know, as much as people think these days, oh, there's got to be some app to fix everything. There's not going to be one for wildfires, but we can enhance our capability to respond to these with technology. And that's data, that's sensors, that's mapping. That's having a better and deeper understanding of each fire, as well as the totality of the fire problem every season. And that's getting an accurate acreage burn count, understanding fully what the impact of that burned area is, from watersheds to soil health to economic impacts to the area. There's so much tied into these fire incidents, economically, socially, and ecologically, that getting our hands around that so we can really understand it and manage it is going to be very, very important. So again, I think to sum it up, more aircraft, more assets, initial attack, get there hard and fast, and really invest in data and technology so we can have a more complete understanding of what these fire incidents are doing and the impact they're having.
So special thanks to Tim for joining us on this episode. Again, it's Bridger Aerospace, bridge like you cross, eraerospace.com. Check them out on their website and also social. I fly with a fair amount of pilots that are always, not all of them, but some of them express an interest in getting into aerial firefighting. So if you are interested in getting that industry or just want to learn more about it, check out their site. And of course, their social always has some interesting visual updates as well. If you'd like to learn more about Icon Aircraft, which produces this podcast, go to iconaircraft.com. For the makers of the Icon A5 seaplane, which we alluded to in this episode. So, again, my name is Paul, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Adventure Flying Podcast. We will catch you on the next episode. Thanks again. Bye.